Steve could be tremendously helpful to friends and colleagues in times of need, especially when they or their families needed medical treatment. He could also be cold and insensitive to coworkers when their personal issues obstructed what he saw as the company's mission, or distracted them from giving Apple their full attention. With a little more empathy and a little more caring for those who weren't critical to his cause, Steve could have saved himself and Apple from a handful of unnecessary headaches. For the rest of his time at Apple, Steve would manage the company with a mix of old-timers and newcomers. Cook and Ive had been with him for years by now, as had communications chief Katie Cotton and Phil Schiller, the good-natured head of marketing. Sina Tamadden and Eddie Q had gradually become part of the core, and Steve promoted Fidel to head up the hardware side of the iPhone project, and Forstall, another former NextWiz, to handle the software. Forstall and Fidel could have become the next Avi and Ruby, had they not viewed each other as rivals from the very start. They would clash and undercut each other even more than Fidel had banged heads with Ive and Ruby. Steve found himself refereeing disputes that were beginning to threaten the vaunted synergy that had always been Apple's secret sauce, the blending of clever hardware and ingenious software into a single magical digital widget. In fact, Fidel was such an explosive force that he would leave the company in 2009 and head off to form a new company called Nest Labs, which makes a thermostat and a smoke detector that work with your home Wi-Fi network. Fidel is not remembered fondly in the Apple executive boardroom. When certain Apple higher-ups speak of him now, they sneer at the designer of that little thermostat. The definition of little is relative, of course. In 2014, Google paid $3.2 billion to acquire Fidel's Nest Labs. In the last years of his life, two avoidable controversies distracted Jobs from what he really wanted to be doing: working with this group on great new products. The two events played out, even after his death, in ways that made Apple and Steve seem arrogant, willful, and above the law. Starting in the mid-2000s, Steve was the informal leader of a group of Silicon Valley CEOs who agreed not to poach senior employees from one another. In 2010, the Justice Department filed a complaint against Apple, along with Adobe, Google, Intel, Intuit, and Pixar, alleging that the companies had entered a series of agreements, recorded formally and informally, to not hire from one another. A class-action lawsuit followed in 2011, filed by an engineer at Lucasfilm on behalf of 64,000 employees of these companies and others in Silicon Valley. This lawsuit added Lucasfilm, which, like Pixar, is now owned by Disney, to the list of companies. The plaintiffs alleged that the anti-competitive scheme cost workers billions of dollars in unrealized wage gains they might have enjoyed with unrestricted job mobility. Emails subpoenaed during the investigation show that Steve was clearly involved. They also show him taking mordant pleasure at the fact that a Google recruiter was fired for poaching an Apple employee, after Steve had complained to Eric Schmidt, who was then CEO of the giant search engine company. When Jobs heard the news, his email reply was a smiley face icon. Steve was hardly the only CEO to be caught with incriminating emails, but he was the only one shown making light of the personal impact of the collusion. Other chief executives seemed motivated primarily by a desire to not piss off Steve, who had become the most powerful employer in the technology business. Tim Cook doesn't see anything egregious in Steve's thinking, even though he has since tried to settle the lawsuit by offering to pay hundreds of millions of dollars to participants in the class-action suit. "I know where Steve's head was," he says. "He wasn't doing anything to hold down salaries. It never came up. He had a simple objective. If we were working together on something, like with Intel, where we threw everything in the middle of the table and said, 'Let's convert the Mac to the Intel processor,' well, when we did that, we didn't want them poaching our employees that they were meeting, and they didn't want us poaching theirs. Doesn't it make sense that you wouldn't? That it's an okay thing?" I don't think for a minute he thought he was doing anything bad, and I don't think he was thinking about saving any money. He was just very protective of his employees. It's a rational argument, insofar as it goes. All CEOs want to keep their best employees at their company. But it ignores the simple fact that making such an agreement with other companies, explicitly or otherwise, is illegal, according to the U.S. government and most antitrust lawyers. Steve apparently couldn't be bothered even with acknowledging those rules. That same attitude hurt Apple in another case it had to settle, in which the government alleged that Apple conspired with book publishers to raise the price of e-books. As Steve prepared to launch the iPad, he was sure that reading books on the device would be seen as an attractive feature, one that he hoped would create profits for Apple while stealing customers from Amazon. He and Eddie Q strongly encouraged book publishers to adopt the agency model Apple used on its app and iTunes stores. Publishers could set the price of their e-books as long as Apple got 30% of the sale. Furthermore, they wouldn't allow their titles to be sold at lower prices elsewhere. In this scenario, prices of e-books would have risen uniformly from the low $9.99 price Amazon often charged for new releases. The publishers would have enjoyed smaller profits, but would have been able to set higher prices and avoid permitting Amazon to drive book prices down. Here, too, Steve's emails did nothing to help Apple. His aggressive negotiating notes show that he was fully aware of the impact of getting all the publishers on the same page. Writing to James Murdoch, the son of News Corp CEO Rupert Murdoch, Jobs said that News Corp's best option, he believed, was to throw in with Apple and see if we can all make a go of this to create a real mainstream e-books market at $12.99 and $14.99. It's possible that Steve really didn't see anything wrong with trying to build solidarity among publishers, because he had done the same thing with record company executives when setting up the iTunes music store. Nobody accused him of collusion then, even though he had insisted on setting a price of 99 cents a track. It's also possible that a variety of assorted corporate safeguards, better legal counsel, better compliance efforts, and so on, could have kept Apple on the right side of the law in both the e-books case and the labor collusion. But Steve had molded Apple into a tool for turning what unfolded in his imagination into real products, not an organization that conservatively guarded against the downside of his impulses. So the safeguards that did exist weren't powerful enough to prevent the troubles that arose. Steve created a management approach that worked for the type of product that he had been thinking about, Bill Gates told me after Steve's death. You know, if you were going to do hardware and software together, and you're going to do a few super, super nice designs, and you're going to do it end-to-end where partnerships aren't the key thing, where you control that experience totally. He managed a great organization that was purpose-fit to that. We have been chatting about why so many books have been written promising to reveal how to do business the Apple way or the Steve Jobs way. Bill was describing why Steve is a unique managerial case, someone whose model has limited applications. Maybe you should call your book Don't Try This at Home, he said, only half-joking. So many of the people who want to be like Steve have the asshole side down. What they're missing is the genius part. One downside to the Steve Jobs way of running a company, he opined, is that this is not an organization with checks and controls. All his life, Steve had tried to control the narrative about Apple by being the sole employee to tell its story to the public. There was a cost to this choice that didn't really become apparent until the last years of Steve's life, when his notoriety and Apple's success drew attention to Cupertino as never before. Apple became the lightning rod for everything from criticism of the tech industry's sustainability problems to corporate governance controversies that affected many other companies as well. And its spokesman was a mortally unhealthy man with a desperate impatience to deal with things that really mattered to him, not this broad array of nagging distractions. Ever since getting sick in 2004, Steve had kept goals in his head of things he wanted to be alive for. Some were personal, like the school graduations of his kids. Some were corporate, like his desire to live long enough to introduce the iPad tablet computer. Dealing with the media circus that erupted in 2010 when a technology blog came into possession of an iPhone 4 prototype that a young Apple engineer left in a bar was nowhere on Steve's list. Nora was flying back from a Hawaii vacation to manage an uproar that became known as AntennaGate, the result of the discovery that the iPhone 4, if held at certain angles, would drop calls more frequently than past iPhones. And he had only passing sensitivity to corporate governance issues. Yet all these incidents, and more, added to the already immense task he faced of managing a sprawling international company with nearly 50,000 employees during these years when he was, quite truly, dying. It is part of the CEO's job description to manage such distractions. And Steve was not particularly good at this, even when he was healthy. He had always been impatient. But the cancer was exhausting him and bringing the kind of wearing pain he had never before experienced. Not surprisingly, Steve bollocksed up things that he might have handled with ease under different, healthier circumstances. For instance, reasonable people can disagree on the subject of whether Steve had a fiduciary responsibility to disclose his cancer earlier than he did, and to then keep the public informed of its progress. Steve felt, and perhaps naively wished, that this was a private matter, and so he skirted the truth about his disease again and again. But calling Nocera a slime bucket, when the Times columnist called to address the issue, did little for the reputation of Apple or its CEO. Similarly, Steve's public comments about Apple's response to the controversy that was set off when a spate of suicides occurred at the Chinese campuses of Foxconn, its leading assembler of iPhones, did more to hurt Apple than help it, in a situation where its record was actually fairly good for a big global corporation. As Apple built up a supply chain that delivered more and more iPhones, iPods, iTouches, Nanos, and the like, it annually audited working conditions at the factories of its suppliers, and even of its suppliers' subcontractors. But problems slipped past these audits. That's not unusual. Not surprisingly, the conditions of Asian manufacturing plants have been worrisome for decades. That's unlikely to change. In a system set up purely to secure the lowest costs for U.S. and European manufacturers, workers are unlikely to be paid or treated particularly well. When Apple learned of the suicides, it actually responded quickly, pulling together a noteworthy task force to investigate Foxconn's factories, and taking other actions that some observers have deemed forward-looking. Again, reasonable people can disagree about the quality of Apple's response. But what everyone can agree on is that Steve didn't help matters with some of his public responses to the crisis, including the moment at a tech conference when he said, "Oh, we're all over this one." He sounded glib in the way of any corporate CEO trying to smooth over an inconvenient truth. Steve had come a long way in moderating some of the behaviors that had made the young man at the Garden of Allah such a volatile, difficult presence. Some of his old foibles hung on with persistence. Others had been tamed. And at the moment when the pressures of his job would have benefited most from his evolution, his illness added to the complexity of his task. Heroic narratives aren't supposed to have chapters like this. In the typical Pixar movie, or in the Disney animations that started getting better and better toward the end of Steve's life, true emotions are unfrozen. Reconciliations are wholly achieved. But Steve's life wasn't a movie. It was inspiring, confounding, and unabashedly human, to the very end. Chapter 17. Just tell them I'm being an asshole. In early December 2008, Steve called me at my home office in Foster City, California. He said he had something important to tell me. For several months, I had been working to set up a joint interview of Steve, Andy Grove, Bill Gates, and Michael Dell. The confab was supposed to kick off the reporting for a book I had in mind. I had what I thought was a snappy title, Founders, Keepers, and a plan to describe how a handful of geeky entrepreneurs had evolved into captains of industry, how self-absorbed inventors morphed into self-taught empire builders, how shaggy-haired idealists managed to stay in the saddle even as the companies they created grew rapidly by orders of magnitude, and as their own wealth and influence over the world itself became far more than the stuff of dreams. I had intended to get started on the book in 2005, but while traveling on a road trip to Nicaragua for what was supposed to be a long vacation, I became very sick. Endocarditis lodged on the artificial heart valve that had been implanted in my aorta 8 years before, and it had spread from there throughout my body. In my spinal column, the infection gestated into meningitis, and from there entered the lining of my brain. Other infections landed in a lung, in my intestines, and elsewhere throughout my body. Doctors in a Managua hospital saved my life, but only by inducing a coma and blasting me with antibiotics that, while quelling the infection, caused me to lose 65% of my hearing, including going completely deaf in one ear. My employer, Time Inc., had me medevaced by jet back to Stanford Hospital in Palo Alto, where I endured 3 weeks in the intensive care unit. The doctors there were puzzled by what exactly was keeping me so sick. During this time, Steve came to visit me in the hospital a couple of times. I was so addled with sedatives and painkillers and my own delirious hallucinations that during one visit I expressed my sincerest regrets at not being able to play saxophone in a Beatles retrospective show he was planning to put on in Las Vegas with Ringo Starr and Paul McCartney. Somehow, I had thought he had taken up guitar in order to play the part of John Lennon himself, and he had asked me to be part of the backup band. Unfortunately, I explained to Steve, with my new hearing loss problem, I'd never be able to pull it off. Apparently, Steve and my wife, Lorna, had a good laugh. At least that's what she told me later when I had regained my senses. She also said that before leaving, he said, I've told them to give you the VIP treatment here. Call me if you need anything. We stayed in touch, off and on by email, over the coming few years, as I slowly recovered in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I managed to write one last cover story for Fortune by turning a series of 4 interviews with Pixar's John Lasseter into his own first-person narrative. Steve didn't make time for photographs or even a short interview for the story, despite his closeness to Lasseter. It turns out that he had decided not to work with me on magazine stories anymore. Perhaps my zany behavior during the hospital visits had convinced him that I would never be able to tell Apple's or Pixar's stories with the same level of sophistication I had applied in the past. Or perhaps it was something else. I never did learn his reason. Despite having no interest in working with me on magazine articles, Steve seemed genuinely curious about the book idea. He and I had discussed the project a few times, and in the spring of 2008, I told him I wanted to set up a roundtable discussion of around 8 founders as the centerpiece of my reporting. That's way too many people, he snorted. Everybody will want their camera time, and nobody will say much of anything honest or real. Instead, he suggested, focus your book on the emergence of the PC. There are 4 of us, really. Me, Bill, Andy Grove, and Michael Dell. Get us together, and we'll have a good discussion. It will be more focused. We know each other's weaknesses and strengths. It will make a much better story for you to tell, and we'll all have to be more honest. He even offered to help me wrangle the other 3, although I told him I didn't think that was necessary. Just being able to tell them that Steve wanted to do it was enough to get them to readily buy into the idea. Announcing Steve's involvement was like waving a magic wand. I got immediate responses from the other 3, despite their very tight schedules. After some back and forth, we set a date for converging at the offices of Andy Grove's Family Foundation in downtown Los Altos, California, on Thursday, December 18th. All four committed to spend lunch and the entire afternoon together. Andy's longtime admin, Terry Murphy, arranged for the food after I had consulted with Lenita Burkhead, Steve's administrative assistant, about what would work for her notoriously finicky boss. Sushi, perhaps a salad, and herbal tea. But here Steve was, in the early afternoon of December 11th, calling me at home on the phone. "Hi, Brent, this is Steve." Before waiting for me to respond, he immediately announced, "I really hate to have to say this, but I just can't make it next Thursday." I couldn't believe what I was hearing. "Steve, we've been planning on this for 6 months. Everybody else cleared out a whole day on their schedules so they could be here for this. Lenita said everything was all set last week. We can't do it if you aren't there." "Sure you can," he said. I didn't say anything. I just sat there and waited for him to explain. "I have to tell you, Brent, my health has really gone downhill. I can't put on any weight. You know me, I'm a vegan, and I've even started getting chocolate milkshakes now, eating cheese, anything. But I keep wasting away. You wouldn't want to see me like this." "The others wouldn't either. Lorene says I can't wait any longer, I have to deal with this. And she's right." I asked him about the earlier surgery and why he had insisted so strongly that he had been cured. Was it his pancreas still? Or was it something else? He told me it was some sort of endocrine disorder that seemed to have made it difficult for his body to digest food. "I eat something and it goes right through me," he said. "Whatever it is, I have to drop everything else and figure it out now. It has to be my only priority. I owe it to my family. I haven't even told the board or Tim and the others this yet, but I'm going to have to take another medical leave. Macworld is coming up, so I have to announce it before then, because I don't think I can do that either." Then his tone changed. "I've always told you what was happening with my health, because you can relate. So I'm sure you know you can't tell anyone else about this. It's just between you and me. That's why I called, because I wanted to tell you myself. I wanted you to know that I really wanted to do this with you too. But I just can't." Sitting there on the edge of the daybed in my home office, I tried to imagine what Steve must look like. I hadn't seen him in the flesh since the Worldwide Developers Conference at Moscone Center in San Francisco the previous June. He had looked thin then, but he had also had a spring in his step. iPhones were flying out of the stores, and the App Store was selling apps by the millions. iMacs, now pristine white rectangular slabs that floated in front of you, were selling better than ever. And the new MacBook Air, the laptop equivalent of a sleek supermodel, was the latest IT device. "So what am I supposed to say to Bill and Andy and Michael?" I asked. "They're going to want to know why you are pulling out at the very last minute. Should I tell them you aren't feeling up to it?" "I won't say anything more than that." At first, Steve didn't answer. Then, after a few beats, with a mordant giggle, he said, "Just tell them I'm being an asshole. That's what they'll probably be thinking anyway. So why not just say it?" I was dumbfounded. "Do you really want me to say that?" I replied, thinking that none of them would buy it for a minute. They knew that Steve wouldn't have put me up to the whole round table thing only to back out. He could be a jerk, but he wasn't an asshole. "All I ask is that you just don't tell them the real reason. Not yet." I didn't tell Michael or Andy or Bill anything other than that Steve had to cancel because of a personal conflict that had come up. A month or so later, after Apple had announced Steve's medical leave for complex health-related issues, I saw Bill at his office in Kirkland, Washington. He told me he wanted to get in touch with Steve and wasn't sure of the best means. It had been a long time since they had spoken. I gave him Steve's home phone number and his cell phone number, and also the email address and phone number of his assistant, Lenita, but not before relating the story of the asshole excuse Steve had suggested. Bill loves a smart riposte as much as anyone, so we had a good laugh. According to Tim Cook, he and Katie Cotton, Apple's communications chief, first learned about Steve's need for a liver transplant in January 2009, a few weeks after Steve and I spoke. But he had watched Steve wither away during 2008. By early 2009, Steve wasn't coming into the office at all, and Cook would visit him at home just about every day. He started to worry that things might finally be headed in a fatal direction. It was terrible going over there day after day and talking with him, because you could see him slipping day after day, says Cook. Steve was starting to look alarmingly frail. He developed ascites, an accumulation of fluid in the peritoneal cavity that caused his belly to protrude in ghastly fashion, and he just lay in bed all day, gaunt and tired and irritable. He was on the list of people in California who were awaiting a liver transplant. This isn't a list that can be gamed. At one of their many bedside meetings, Steve told Cook that he thought he might have a better chance at a liver transplant than others because he had a rare blood type. It wasn't a statement that made any sense to Cook, because while there were fewer applicants on the list with Steve's blood type, there were also fewer people of that blood type whose livers could be transplanted to him. In fact, Steve's chances of getting a donor were not good at all. One afternoon, Cook left the house feeling so upset that he had his own blood tested. He found out that he too had a rare blood type, and made the assumption that it might be the same as Steve's. He started doing research, and learned that it is possible to transfer a portion of a living person's liver to someone in need of a transplant. About 6,000 living donor transplants are performed every year in the United States, and the rate of success for both donor and recipient is high. The liver is a regenerative organ. The portion transplanted into the recipient will grow to a functional size, and the portion of the liver that the donor gives up will also grow back. Cook decided to undergo a battery of tests that determine if someone is healthy enough to be a living donor. "I thought he was going to die," Cook explains. He went to a hospital far from the Bay Area since he didn't want to be recognized. The day after he returned from the trip, he went to visit Steve. And there, sitting alone with him in the bedroom of the Palo Alto house, Tim began to offer his liver to Steve. "I really wanted him to do it," he remembers. "He cut me off at the legs, almost before the words were out of my mouth." "No," he said, "I'll never let you do that. I'll never do that." "Somebody that's selfish," Cook continues, "doesn't reply like that. I mean, here's a guy, he's dying, he's very close to death because of his liver issue, and here's someone healthy offering a way out. I said, 'Steve, I'm perfectly healthy, I've been checked out. Here's the medical report. I can do this, and I'm not putting myself at risk. I'll be fine.' And he doesn't even think about it. It was not, 'Are you sure you want to do this?' It was not, 'I'll think about it.' It was not, 'Oh, the condition I'm in.' It was, 'No, I'm not doing that.' He kind of popped up in bed and said that. And this was during a time when things were just terrible. Steve only yelled at me 4 or 5 times during the 13 years I knew him, and this was one of them. This picture of him isn't understood, says Cook. I thought the Walter Isaacson book did him a tremendous disservice. It was just a rehash of a bunch of stuff that had already been written and focused on small parts of his personality. You get the feeling that Steve's a greedy, selfish egomaniac. It didn't capture the person. The person I read about there is somebody I would never have wanted to work with over all this time. Life is too short." In saying this, Cook echoed the feeling of many of Steve's close friends. In interview after interview, they complained that very little of what has been published offers any sense of why they would have worked so long and so hard for Steve. Those former employees share another common thread, too. The idea that they did the very best work of their lives for Steve. "Steve cared," Cook continues. "He cared deeply about things. Yes, he was very passionate about things, and he wanted things to be perfect, and that was what was great about him. He wanted everyone to do their best work. He believed that small teams were better than large teams, because you could get a lot more done. And he believed that picking the right person was 100 times better than picking somebody who was a little short of being right. All of those things are really true. A lot of people mistook that passion for arrogance. He wasn't a saint. I'm not saying that. None of us are. But it's emphatically untrue that he wasn't a great human being, and that is totally not understood. The Steve that I met in early 98 was brash and confident and passionate and all of those things. But there was a soft side of him as well. And that soft side became a larger portion of him over the next 13 years. You'd see that show up in different ways. There were different employees and spouses here that had health issues, and he would go out of his way to turn heaven and earth to make sure they had proper medical attention. He did that in a major way, not in a minor, call me and get back to me if you need my help kind of way. He had the courage to admit he was wrong, and to change, a quality which many people at that level, who have accomplished that much, lack. You don't see many people at that level who will change directions even though they should. He wasn't beholden to anything except a set of core values. Anything else, he could walk away from. He could do it faster than anyone I'd ever seen before. It was an absolute gift. He always changed. Steve had this ability to go through a learning curve quickly, more quickly than anybody I've known, about such a wide variety of things. The Steve I knew was the guy pestering me to have a social life, not because he was being a pest, but because he knew how important family was in his life, and he wanted it for me too, continues Cook, who came out publicly as a gay man in 2014. Steve and others at the company had known this for years, of course. One day he calls my mom. He doesn't even know my mom. She lives in Alabama. He said he was looking for me, but he knows how to find me. And he talked to her about me. There are lots of these things where you saw the very soft or caring or feeling or whatever you want to call it side of him. He had that gene. Someone who's viewing life only as a transactional relationship with people doesn't do that. Eventually, Steve did get a liver transplant. He had also registered on another list in Memphis, Tennessee, which was perfectly legal. The only requirements to get on an out-of-state list were that he could make his way to the hospital within 8 hours of being told that a liver was available. Since Steve had a private jet, he could do so, and that he be judged healthy enough to recover from the surgery by a team of doctors from the admitting hospital. He and Lorene flew to Memphis for the surgery on March 21, 2009. Because of complications, he required a second surgery a couple of days later. He and Lorene remained in Memphis for 2 excruciating months, during which things were so touch and go that relatives and close friends, such as Johnny Ive, Mona Simpson, Steve's lawyer, George Riley, and others came to visit and perhaps say goodbye to him. Ive even brought a special present from the Apple design team, a meticulous miniature aluminum replica of the MacBook Pro that would ship in June. The designers had made these nano models for Steve after every product release. Given the circumstances, this one was special. Steve survived, of course. He later told Bob Iger that he had considered leaving Apple after the operation to spend more time with his children at home. But as Eddie Q says, Steve really just had 2 things he cared about in his life, Apple, and to some extent Pixar, and his family. He needed both. He returned to work, and just as he had after his 2004 operation, he did so with vigor. He had a new milestone he wanted to achieve before he died. The introduction of the iPad. Developing the iPad was easier, technologically, than creating the iPod or the iPhone. In the first instance, the team had to learn an utterly new way to operate. In the case of the iPhone, Apple pushed the personal computer revolution to its pinnacle by melding 3 devices into 1 handheld supercomputer. Now, armed with the experience of those 2 battles, Steve and his team were able to create something whose attributes were ethereal and unexpected. Back in 2004, Steve had shifted Project Purple away from the tablet and toward the phone. By doing so, he ensured that Apple's tablet device would be a line extension of the iPhone. When his team turned to building the iPad, they maximized an iPhone rather than opt to minimize an iMac. That meant using ARM-based microprocessors, which are common in smartphones, rather than the more power-hungry Intel chips that drive many computers. That meant adopting the iPhone's multi-touch screen and virtual keyboard. Perhaps most important of all, and most ironic, given Steve's initial resistance, the iPad would benefit enormously from the iTunes App Store. The iPad gave software developers a much more powerful target to shoot for than the iPhone, mainly because the larger screen made it possible and practical to do some really cool things that you could not do on a pocket-sized device. Often sold at the same low price points as iPhone apps, these cool new iPad apps seemed like an even better deal as they exploded on those bigger screens. The iPad multiplied the importance of the App Store and the influence of the new market and business model for software that it had created. With the 1-2 punch of the iPhone and the iPad, Apple had completely reshaped the business of making and selling consumer software. Where once upon a time, developers had to price their software applications so that they might make a profit from the sale of a few thousand copies, they now could sell into a market of hundreds of millions of people. This tremendous opportunity has led to all kinds of developments that never would have even had a glimmer of a chance in a smaller market. Name what you want to do now, and there is probably an app, or two, or three, or ten, for that. That wasn't true in the PC world, because the price points necessary to achieve profitability on a much smaller volume of sales were simply too high. Looked at in the context of Steve's career as a technologist, the iPad is not as significant a product as the iPhone. But in some ways, it is the most elegant evocation of some of his enduring goals, to create technology that is a window into the limitless world of information, and to create technology that is so simple and so powerful that it basically disappears. His sense of those essential goals is what distinguished him from the more tech-savvy hobbyists back at the start of his career. His restless desire to reach that goal had betrayed him more than once, causing him to try to leap before the technology was ready even to walk. But by the time he and his team got around to creating the iPad, he had learned enough, finally, to make the technology essentially invisible. A true artist, he'd finally hidden all evidence of his labor. Steve's sense of pleasure and satisfaction with this outcome was evident on January 27, 2010, when he introduced the iPad at San Francisco's Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. This time, the stage was set with a small couch and a table, props that weren't the standard for his product demos. When Steve walked onto the stage, looking gaunt, he received, as always, a standing ovation. He paced confidently and energetically as he proudly recounted some of the company's achievements. A slide of him with Woz from the early days was projected above him as the statistics rolled out. 250 million iPods sold. 3 billion downloads from the App Store in a year and a half. Revenues exceeding $50 billion annually. Apple, he explained, is now a mobile device company. In fact, by revenues, it is the largest mobile device company in the world. There was something elegiac about all this, even though Steve often used the first moments of a presentation to update the crowd on Apple. This, after all, was a recitation of the story of his professional life, and the sentimental nature of the event grew when, after a dozen or so minutes, Steve sat down in the leather love seat to demonstrate how easy it was to use an iPad. This was, of course, a concession to his weakened state of health. But it served the product, too. He leaned back and navigated through a series of things you could do with your fingers on the iPad, send email, surf the web, open up apps that let you listen to music, watch videos on YouTube, or even make digital finger paintings. It's so much more intimate than a laptop, he stated with great satisfaction. His every move was projected on the big screen. Like every other presentation he had ever given, this one was staged with a clear intention, to show that this device was actually an invitation to a new kind of computing, something so natural and relaxed that it would slip right into your daily life with unimaginable ease. While the iPad drew its fair share of initial criticism, the public instantly understood its appeal. The first-generation iPad was the fastest-selling debut product Apple had ever unleashed, racking up numbers that made the launches of the iPod and the iPhone pale by comparison. By the end of 2010, the company had sold nearly 15 million iPads. In 2009, Steve had returned with vigor, just as he had after the initial operation back in 2004. But this time it was different. This time everyone understood that his return would end, and they understood how it would end, even if they didn't know when. There was no talk of being cured. Instead, Steve was going to live with it as long as possible. Steve didn't talk to many people about his medical woes, and he didn't even spend much time discussing it overtly with his inner circle. But the real prospect of his death was there, and it was noticeable. Bob Iger was aware of it. As Iger had expected, Steve had been a meaningful and yet unthreatening member of the Disney board ever since the Pixar sale in 2006. His relationship with Iger had become so strong that Steve had wanted Iger to join the Apple board, which Iger couldn't do for fiduciary reasons. In fact, because of their friendship, Iger also turned down an invitation from Sergey Brin, Larry Page, and Eric Schmidt to be on Google's board. "He told me he'd be jealous," says Iger, with a wistful grin, although given how Apple's relationship with Google eventually disintegrated, there was likely more to Steve's reluctance than mere envy. Before the liver transplant, Iger and Steve talked three or four times a week. They even saw each other over winter vacations in Hawaii. "I was at the Four Seasons and he was at Kona Village. We'd walk together a lot. He had a daily walk that ended at the Four Seasons. We would walk and he'd try to convince me of stuff like, say, that white pineapple is better than yellow pineapple. And we'd sit on benches and talk about music and the world. That's where I told him the exciting news that we were looking to build a resort in Hawaii, a $900 million resort. I could tell he didn't like the idea. I said, why not? He said it wasn't a big enough idea. I said, $900 million? Disney comes to Hawaii? That's not a big idea? What's a big idea in your mind? He said, buy Lanai, a small island in the state that was eventually purchased by Larry Ellison. He thought we should build a theme park on the island, have all the visitors brought there by a special Disney transportation service. It was totally impractical. Most often, the two would meet in Burbank when Steve came down to Disney headquarters for board meetings. Even though Iger was not on the Apple board, he would join it after Steve's death, Steve would seek his advice about things going on at the company and walk him through Johnny Ive's design lab whenever he came up to Cupertino. "We would stand at a whiteboard, brainstorming," remembers Iger. "We talked about buying companies. We talked about buying Yahoo together." By the time the Disney board meetings came around, Steve had usually been fully briefed by Iger. "We saw eye to eye on most things," says Iger. "It wasn't anything pre-planned, but when Steve opined, the board generally listened." That wasn't true on everything, but Steve voiced his disagreements in a forceful but civil fashion. Steve hated stock buybacks, when companies purchase their own shares on the public market, a move that is supposed to be both a good investment for the company and a signal of its confidence to big investors. He made a strong case against it at one board meeting, but the company proceeded nonetheless. On the other hand, when Disney was about to enter a joint venture with Carnival Cruise Lines because Iger didn't think he could get the board's support to build two new billion-dollar cruise ships. Steve passionately urged him, and eventually the board, to have Disney build the ships itself. "If this is a good business," he said, "why are you going to put your brand in someone else's hands?" Disney built the two new ships on its own. Steve also helped with Disney's retail business. In 2008, the company had bought back its stores, after having licensed them to outside operators for years. When the new head of retail first pitched the board on his plans, Steve, who always sat next to Iger, grew restless and started rolling his eyes. At one point during the presentation, he just burst out, muttering "bullshit" in a way that everyone could hear. Iger kicked him in the shins to try to get him to muzzle himself. Once the presentation had ended, Steve asked the executive two simple questions. What message are you sending to your customer when they walk through the door? What statement are you making? The guy couldn't answer the questions, remembers Iger. There was silence in the room. Afterward, Steve told Iger he should fire the executive immediately. But Iger didn't. Steve was quick to judge people. That was a fault, says Iger. If he got better on that, it wasn't something I saw. I always found that a shortcoming. I'd say to him, first of all, I haven't decided about the person, so you've got to give me a chance to form my own opinion. Or I'd tell him, you're just flat out wrong about this person. In some cases, he was proved right. And in others, I was. Either way, I never got an I told you so from him. A few weeks later, Iger brought the retail chief and a couple of others up to Cupertino for a day-long brainstorming session with Steve and Apple retail chief Ron Johnson. He didn't redesign our stores, says Iger. He didn't even set foot in them, as far as I know. But he did give us a full day of his time, and they helped us come up with a guiding statement about the stores. This is going to be the best 20 or 30 minutes of your kid's day. In the last couple of years, it grew harder for Steve to travel, and he had to call in to some board meetings. But when he could make it down to Burbank for a meeting, he and Iger always tried to spend time together. Iger remembers the night when it really hit him that Steve was going to pass away, during a 2010 dinner at his home with his wife, Steve, and Lorreen. We all kind of knew there was an inevitability to him dying, not that any of us was willing to truly accept it, believe it, or articulate it, Iger recalls. But it was pretty evident. Steve made a toast that night. He said, "The two of us did an unbelievable thing, didn't we? We saved Disney and we saved Pixar." He thought that being part of Disney had breathed a whole new life into Pixar. And clearly, Disney has never been the same since. Tears came to his eyes. Our wives had a hard time maintaining dry eyes. It was one of those moments. "Hey, look at what we did. My goodness. Wasn't that cool? Wasn't that really special?" At Apple, Steve still did everything he could to have people treat him as if he were not sick. He was working his ass off till the end, in pain, remembers Eddie Q. You could see it in the meetings. He was taking morphine, and you could see he was in pain, but he was still interested. He did make some adjustments upon his return, most of which were simply extensions of the shifts in priority he'd made after his 2004 operation. He focused on the parts of the ongoing business he cared about most, marketing, design, and the product introductions, and he started to take active steps to ensure that he would leave Apple in good shape after his death. This was a process that had started earlier. Tim Cook says that Steve started thinking of succession and the post-Steve era of the company back in 2004. But everything accelerated now. He spent some of his time working with Joel Podolny, a professor he had hired away from the Yale School of Management, to develop the curriculum for an executive education program he wanted to create called Apple University. Unlike Pixar University, where all employees can choose from a range of eclectic courses that instruct them in creative arts and skills employed by others at the studio, Apple U is designed as a place where future leaders of the company can review and dissect momentous decisions in the company's history. It's an attempt to reverse engineer and then bottle Steve's decision-making process, and to pass on his aesthetics and marketing methodologies to Apple's next generation. Steve cared deeply about the why, says Cook, the why of the decision. In the younger days, I would see him just do something. But as the days went on, he would spend more time with me and with other people explaining why he thought or did something, or why he looked at something in a certain way. This was why he came up with Apple U, so we could train and educate the next generation of leaders by teaching them all we had been through, and how we had made the terrible decisions we made, and also how we made the really good ones. Steve also focused on Apple's new headquarters, which are now being built on the grounds of the old Hewlett-Packard campus in another neighborhood of Cupertino. He was very actively involved in the design, working with Norman Foster Architects. The building will reflect many of the same thoughts that went into the creation of Pixar's headquarters, albeit with an Apple spin. It will be one huge circular structure, 4 stories tall, and housing up to 13,000 employees. Some people compare it to a space station. Its design is intended to promote interaction among employees. A common hallway stretches around the entire circle of each floor. A single cafe area will seat 3,000 people. Some 80% of the grounds will be covered in shrubs, bushes, and trees, including a huge area in the middle of the circular structure. And the building will be its own technological marvel. Its exterior won't have a single pane of flat or rectilinear glass. Instead, the walls of the building will consist of enormous panels of perfectly curved glass. The cafeteria will have sliding, curved glass doors, 4 stories tall, to open up when the weather is nice. "I think we have a shot," Steve told the Cupertino City Council, "at building the best office building in the world." Steve's approach to the creation of the campus was driven by the same principles as always. What kind of design would make the new headquarters complex the ideal place for Apple to create its own future? The closer you could get to that ideal, the better for Apple. He wanted to do everything he could to ensure that Apple would remain what he believed it had become, the most important, most vital, and most creative industrial company in the world. Steve wanted people to love Apple, says Cook, not just work for Apple, but really love Apple, and really understand at a very deep level what Apple was about the values of the company. He didn't write them on the walls and make posters out of them anymore, but he wanted people to understand them. He wanted people to work for a greater cause. This belief in Apple as a special place, as a company as magical, perhaps, as an iPad, was something Steve shared with Cook, and was certainly part of the reason he urged the board of directors to sign off on Cook as his successor. "This was a significant common thread we had," says Cook. "I really love Apple, and I do think Apple is here for a bigger reason." There are very few companies like that on the face of the earth anymore. The pain from the cancer was relentless, and Steve spent more and more time at home. Liu Clow visited him there to work on the ad campaign for the iPad 2, which would be launched in the spring of 2011. "We had to go to his house when he was sick because he wasn't coming in," says Clow. "But he had the same kind of laser-intense focus. He wanted to talk about the ad or the product or whatever we were doing." With Clow, Steve didn't spend much time looking back or looking into dark corners of the future. To the end, he tried to will that it, his death, wasn't going to happen, that he was going to somehow keep going. He really didn't want to dwell on that. They worked hard on that introductory iPad 2 ad. Its stentorian tone and poetic language would bear a striking resemblance to the Think Different campaign that signaled the beginning of Apple's miraculous turnaround after Steve had returned to Cupertino. "This is what we believe, that technology alone is not enough," were the words they settled on. "Faster, thinner, lighter, those are all good things. But when technology gets out of the way, everything becomes more delightful, even magical. That's when you leap forward. That's when you end up with something like this." The words accompanied a video showing a single finger manipulating iPad apps with casual ease. It was the last thing that he blessed as the message that should go out for that particular product, remembers Clow. And it came off of Steve's vision very clearly. It summed up his vision from day one that somehow technology should change people's lives and make them better. It should be something that everyone uses. There was considerable doubt as to whether he'd be well enough to introduce the product himself. But when he did make it onto the stage to introduce the iPad 2 on March 2, 2011, his words echoed the themes of the ad. "It's in Apple's DNA that technology alone is not enough," he told the crowd. "We believe that it is technology married with the humanities that yields us the results that make our hearts sing." The iPad 2 was a significant improvement over the first version. It was lighter, it had two digital cameras, one on the screen side to facilitate video conferencing and taking selfies, and another with a higher resolution camera and flash on the backside, courtesy of that crew of camera engineers that had been brought on board after the first iPhone. Still, the obvious improvements in quality of the product came second, at least for that day, to the bigger news that Steve Jobs was clearly dying. His appearance was such that the stock dropped immediately after he stiffly walked onto the stage. This time, he relied even more on other Apple executives to fill out the program and demonstrate key features. Steve had been living with illness for so long, with the bad times coming in unpredictable waves, that neither he nor his colleagues nor his doctors had any sense of when the end would come. When Steve presented his plans for the ambitious new Apple corporate campus to the Cupertino City Council on June 7th, he was visibly hurting, and his voice was weak. Steve seemed to know that it was his last big contribution to the company and to the community it had always called home. So he steeled himself to spend 15 minutes walking the council members through the proposal for the building, and about 5 minutes answering questions. When one councilwoman tried to joke with him that perhaps the city should get free Wi-Fi in return for approving the move, Steve said, "Well, you know, I'm kind of old-fashioned. I believe that we pay taxes, and that the city then gives us services." Over the last few months, a steady flow of visitors came by the house in Palo Alto. Bill Clinton came to visit, as did President Obama, for dinner with a select group of Silicon Valley leaders. John Markoff of the New York Times and Stephen Levy, who had written several books about Silicon Valley, including ones about the development of the Macintosh and the iPod, dropped by together to pay their respects. Bill Gates wound up spending 4 hours with Steve one afternoon. "Steve and I will always get more credit than we deserve, because otherwise the story's too complicated," Gates says. "I mean, yes, Steve did brilliant work, and if you had to say, you know, leave me out of it, one person who had the most impact on the personal computer industry, particularly from where we sit now, you'd pick Steve Jobs." "That's fair. But the difference between him and the next thousand isn't like, you know, God was born and he came down from the hill with the tablet." The two had developed a friendship and a sense of mutual respect, despite their differences. "There was none of that need to put the other person down that afternoon," says Gates. "We just talked about the things we'd done and where we thought things were headed." Gates wrote him a final personal letter just weeks before his death. The members of his executive team came by regularly. His worsening health made an already tight group of executives even closer. They talked with him about work, and sometimes they'd just hang around to watch a movie or have dinner. Their work together on what Cook calls the treadmill of Apple's perpetual innovation machine had only intensified as the company gained momentum. Steve had been